It all started as an inside joke among friends, but the website Stuff White People Like spread like wildfire and became an internet hit. Christian Lander is the creator of the site, and he'll be talking with us this morning about the website and why it's so funny it hurts for a lot of people. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Christian Lander's new book is called Stuff White People Like, The Definitive Guide to the Unique Tastes of Millions. Well, what do you think? Which white people is the website talking about? And does it hit you where it hurts? Also, do you have any additions to Christian Lander's website that you want him to consider? It's still up and running. You can call us this morning at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Christian Lander, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me. Before we start, I want to say, so I live in California. I live in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
Yesterday, I was doing an in-studio interview at the NPR in Pasadena, and I was on the air when the earthquake hit. So
oh,
if I
gosh.
Seem a little nervous, it's because I'm sort of associating NPR interviews with earthquakes from now on.
I thought you were going to say you felt like you were trapped in a Saturday Night Live skit.
Well, what happened was the host was actually reading the book's entry on public radio when the earthquake happened. So I said that it was a ripple in the space-time irony continuum.
I've never been in an earthquake. I've always thought they seemed pretty intense.
It's sort of like being in a house that's near a subway track.
Hmm. The earth shifts, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we'll cross our fingers. So I know I'll be safe here in Wisconsin, but hopefully you will be there too. No aftershocks.
That would be fantastic.
Well, tell us about your website, Stuff White People Like. How did that get started?
The whole thing got started on January 18th of this year, when my friend Miles and I were having an instant messenger conversation about TV show The Wire. And Miles, who's Filipino, said that he didn't trust any white person who didn't watch the show. And then we started talking about, well, what are they doing instead of watching the show? And we came back with ideas like going to plays, going to therapy, doing yoga, getting divorced. And I thought it was a really funny idea. And I said, all right, it's blog time. And I just started writing.
What was your first entry?
Coffee.
Coffee.
Now, none of these things are weighted. I mean, you know, number one is just number one. But it went up because when I was thinking about white people, at least the white people I'm talking about, and we can get into that a little later, there was always this guy in high school, in the ninth grade, who would be the first one to start drinking coffee, and he would attach a refillable mug to his backpack, and you knew there was no way that he actually enjoyed it. It was like smoking, and it was always a white guy, every single...
Ooh, Christian, are you still there?
Yes.
Oh, you cut out for a minute there. I was worried. Okay. So the coffee was the first one, and you know, I want to give, for people who haven't been to your website, I just want to give them a taste of what this is like. Do you have a little reading there you got ready you could do for us?
Yeah, there's one... I have a few. One of my favorite ones that I want to read is a marathon. This is an enjoyable one. So I'll do a short reading from number 27, marathons. In life, there are certain milestones of physical activity that can define you. A 40-yard dash in under 5 seconds, a 40-inch vertical leap, and so forth. To a white person, the absolute pinnacle of fitness is to run a marathon. Not to win, just to run. White people will train for months, telling everyone who will listen about how they get up early in the morning, how they run when it rains, how it makes them feel so great and gives them energy. When they finish the marathon, they'll generally take a photo of themselves in a pair of New Balance sneakers and running shorts with the marathon number held in both hands above their head in triumph. Seriously, look it up. This is universal. They'll then set goals like running in the Boston Marathon or the New York City Marathon. If you find yourself in a situation where a white person is talking about a marathon, you must be impressed, or you'll lose favor with them immediately. Running for a certain length of time on a specific day is a very important thing to a white person and should not be demeaned. Also worth noting, the more competitive white people prefer triathlons because Kenyans can't afford $10,000 specialty bicycles. If the subject ever comes up, just say that triathletes are in better shape than football and basketball players. It's not true, but it'll make the conversation a lot more genial.
And I have to point out that on your book jacket photo, you are, well, you're a white guy, you're on a
yes.
bike, you're bearded, you
yep.
have what looks like a Whole Foods baguette sticking
yep.
out of your satchel there, and you have New Balance tennis shoes on. So you've hit about five or six of the stuff white people like already.
Oh, there's more. I have an iPod, I have a refillable water bottle, there's a copy of The New Yorker in there, an Apple MacBook, shorts, outdoor performance gear. Yeah, there's a lot. Red hair, there's a lot of stuff in there.
So obviously, you know, this is kind of lovable skewering, but you're not really talking about just white people here, right? You're talking about upper middle class, moneyed white people.
Yeah, left-wing, moneyed white people, absolutely.
Left-wing.
And where that comes from is, so I grew up in Toronto, Canada, in the city. And what happened during my childhood and teenagers was when my dad bought the house that I grew up in the late 70s, my neighborhood was all Chinese immigrants and working class white people. Well, by the time I got to high school, rising property values had essentially pushed all of the working class people out of my neighborhood. And my dad was a high school teacher, but I'm talking, but they'd been pushed out of the neighborhood. And Toronto's never had a very strong right-wing voice. So much like San Francisco or Manhattan, all that was left were these moneyed left-wing liberal elites. And these were the only type of, I mean, obviously I'm one of them, but these were the only type of white people left that I grew up with.
So what do you think about this demographic thinks about this book? Obviously, you've had like 30 million hits on your website. Who's reading it?
The demographic I'm going after. I think that it's done a lot like stand-up comedy, in that it's about sort of pointing out these common truths and common contradictions that we all know and can't stop ourselves from doing. So, for example, on bicycles, I ride a fixed-gear bike in Los Angeles, and I love it more than anything. And I will tell anyone who listens about how great my bike is and how important it is that it only has one gear. And deep down, I know it doesn't really matter. Who cares that it has one gear? But I can't stop myself. And there's all these things that we keep doing, that we need to eat organic food, and we always feel like shopping at Whole Foods is better. We need to buy Apple computers. We need to listen to indie music. We just can't stop ourselves anymore. And that's what this is sort of going after.
It seems to me that this is almost more about branding than anything else. It's all about these iPod, you have Apple in there, Whole Foods gets a by name mention, New Balance sneakers get a by name mention. What is it with this particular group of products?
It's very interesting that they're clearly marketed and branded towards the demographic that I'm talking about. But the other thing about branding that's very interesting in this book is the stuff itself is branded white. So what I mean by that was, growing up, anyone who wasn't white who liked these things, so if an Asian person who was really into marathons and New Balance shoes, would get accused of acting white or accused of being a banana. And I think a lot of people of color are really resonating with this book or really connecting with this book because these are the activities that they know are branded as white. And what's interesting is it's this group of upper middle class liberals who want to believe that they're part of a raceless class. You know, sort of like Colbert, I don't see race. But these activities are inherently branded white because that group is still so overwhelmingly white.
And you've gotten an entry in your book for Barack Obama, which is very short, and it says something like, well, you tell us.
This was post number 8 on the site, and this was at a time when literally 4 people were reading the site. And we kept it short and simple, and it just... White people like Barack Obama because they're afraid that if they don't, they will be considered racist. And that's it.
That's getting pretty dangerous there, huh? Did you get some flack about that one? Because people talk about that and they don't have the sort of irony there that you're wielding.
You know what? I actually really haven't gotten into any trouble for that one. I think people don't even want to bring it up because it might lead to them being accused of being racist, and that could be too much for them to bear.
Well, full disclosure here, you said NPR is on the list.
Yes.
Right? Can you read us a little bit from that one?
Sure. Hang on. Let me flip through. Yeah, it was it's been funny in that I never it was written not really expecting to actually be
interviewed on NPR.
And remember, this was what caused the earthquake in Los Angeles yesterday, as far as I know.
Your chance and fate.
This post on the air, but I'll give it a shot. Number 44, public radio. The lack of a television has left many white people without viable entertainment. And as much as they'd like to believe that they can read books during every moment of their free time, it's simply not possible. They need something to fill the gap and provide background noise while they play on the internet. They need public radio. Public radio provides white people with news and information that has the proper perspective, their own. It's very important for white people to have a news source that isn't tied to profits or major corporations. Public radio has the freedom to pursue hard-hitting stories and provide the only truly objective voice in the national media. Because if a news outlet were to depend on one source for their funding, it would have to constantly produce stories that interest and reassure that group, thus making it almost worthless to people outside of that group. You're probably thinking, wait a second, doesn't public radio get most of its money through donations by white people? If so, you are right. And while this sort of explains NPR's programming choices, political bias, and staff, it's not a good idea to point it out to white people. But not everything is political. Public radio also features This American Life, hosted by Ira Glass. For white women without a television, he is considered the ideal man ahead of Jon Stewart. The program features a collection of white people doing stories about minorities and the wrong kind of white people. It's very entertaining and is the safest and easiest way for white people to learn about these groups. There are many other shows, and literally anything you hear is an appropriate and excellent topic of conversation, provided you announce you heard about it on NPR before approaching the subject. For example, I heard this fascinating piece on NPR about chlamydia. It got me thinking, do any of you guys have an STD? Normally, this would be a very offensive question, but phrased in the context of NPR, it is considered acceptable. Overall, the lesson here is that if you want your time with white people to go smoothly, there are a few things you can do that are more effective than listening to public radio.
I think we've got a mug like that somewhere. I heard it on NPR.
Hopefully it doesn't say chlamydia on the mug. That'd be terrible.
Maybe it will now. I don't know.
Stealing that mug, I'll promise you.
And Ira Glass gets a mention by name there.
Oh, yeah. He's pretty big time. I mean, he's up there. And the book also mentions McSweeney's, Dave Eggers' literary publication. And the people who can go between This American Life and McSweeney's are considered sort of the ultimate level white people. So Sarah Vowell and, you know, Ira Glass are considered sort of true heroes.
Well, now that you've sort of called a whole demographic out on this stuff, are you worried that the products you're talking about, the habits, they're going to kind of jump the shark and people are going to start trying to be a little more different?
No. That's actually never been a concern. It's not going to happen. Although it's very funny, though, is a lot of people say they become self-conscious, who write into the site, tell me they become self-conscious about going after these things, or, you know, at shopping at the Apple store or being at Whole Foods. But they say, I can't stop.
What do you think it is about these things that attract this particular demographic? And, you know, is there a common denominator?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that link it together. One is, I think that the book and what I was going after here is talking about a generation that's post-wealth. And what I mean by that is we still have the ethos of our grandparents about the keeping up with the Joneses mentality and about trying to best your neighbor. But instead of impressing people with the most expensive car or the biggest house or sort of vulgar displays of money, we're doing it instead with, you know, carbon footprints or authenticity or, you know, how much foreign knowledge we have. And it's still a constant competition to sort of prove yourself against your neighbor, but it's done differently. So what a lot of these products do is they reinforce your consumption as being a positive thing. So buying organic food is good for the environment. Driving a Prius, even though it burns gasoline, is good for the environment, and it tells people that you care about the environment. And so these products are as much about making a statement about yourself as they are about the products.
Have people gotten mad at you about this, saying this is just a list of stereotypes and that, you know, it's white bashing?
Yeah. I mean, usually those are people who don't really get it, which is always fun to deal with. And I think that it's interesting when people talk about stereotypes with this. I had one of the commenters on the site once said this really brilliant thing where someone had said just that. They said, you know, these stereotypes are awful. It's perpetrating horrible white stereotypes. And he said that the reason it's okay is that no white person has ever been denied a job because they like yoga.
Hmm.
And I think that kind of captures why this works. And the other thing about this is the stereotypes in this book are done from, it's me talking about me. So I'm going after myself here. And it's not done in a hateful way. It's not meant to bring about hatred towards white people. And what's been great about that is a lot of the spin-off sites, including Stuff Educated Black People Like, Stuff Asians Like, Stuff Brown People Like, Stuff Latinos Like, is done in the same way, in that it's trying to talk about the common experiences of people in America of this race, but not being done in a hateful way. It's not meant to demean anyone. And so it's a slightly different way of talking about race and sort of breaking it down into these things, you know, into just stuff.
Do you think there's anything positive about it besides the laughs?
Well, I think that a lot of people, it makes some people a lot more comfortable to talk about race because, again, you're laughing and you're not put on the defensive. I mean, race is still a really, really big issue in the United States. I mean, this election is going to prove it more than anything, but the minute it comes up, people are sort of on the defensive, and going at it in this humorous way makes it a little bit easier for people to actually talk about it.
I have one suggestion for you.
Okay.
Target.
Target?
Target.
Yeah, that's, it's sort of mentioned in the book a little.
Under what category?
Under hating corporations.
Hating corporations, but everyone I know shops at Target.
Well, no. It, in the post on hating corporations, it says that it's not a good idea to mention Target, Apple, or IKEA because white people prefer to hate the corporations
exceptions.
That don't make the
okay,
stuff
well,
they like.
I think it looms large in the demographic you're talking about, even though it's not expensive and it's not necessarily indie.
Yeah. In spite of the fact everything's made in China and it has low wage labor and it destroys local businesses, they have good industrial design, and what more can you really ask for?
We're going to take a quick break right now and then come back and talk more with Christian Lander. He's a creator of the website Stuff White People Like. It's now been turned into a book by the same name with the subtitle The Definitive Guide to the Unique Taste of Millions. Hoping you'll call in this morning with your take on this. Do you find this stuff funny? Is it hitting close to home for you? And maybe you've got some suggestions for Christian to put up on the website. Maybe you think we shouldn't be joking about this. Maybe you think it's not a positive thing for anybody. Give us a call with your take at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned to Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 1 o'clock, it's Talk of the Nation. After 1, NPR's political junkie talks with Libertarian Party presidential candidate Bob Barr. Veronica Rickert, keeping you company today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network as we talk about stuff white people like. That's the title of a website and a book, both created and written by Christian Lander. And Christian, we've got Mike on the line waiting to talk to you. Let's take Mike's phone call from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask your guest what he means by white people. Because it seems to me that... you know, like someone like Keanu Reeves is regarded as white, even though he has a, you know he's actually biracial, Asian and white. And then you mentioned Barack Obama, you know, he's black and white, and yet he's not regarded as white. So this notion of what is white seems to be more of a social, social construction, if you look white. And I just wanted to mention very briefly, I think one reason that people are comfortable voting for Barack Obama is because his existence doesn't reflect America's original sin of slavery. He's not from an American, African-American slavery background. And this, you know, and to suggest that there's this coherency of, among what it means to be white certainly isn't reflected in Europe, since Europe, you know, Europeans have been slaughtering each other for generations, mm-hmm. up until really late NATO. So I'm just like to know what you mean by white. Does a person have to produce a genealogical chart to prove that there's no person of color in their background?
No. This is much more about white. In this case, is certainly referring more to class than anything else. And because it's going after a group. And there's no need to prove a bloodline about the type of white people that I'm talking about.
So, as we said earlier, this is left-wing, upper-middle-class people.
Yes. And it's especially important because these are people who, in the past, because of the political climate of the United States, have, you know, defined themselves as not white or not wanting to be part of the white that they see as, you know, having elected the current president or that's destroying the world, and they sort of want to define themselves against that and sort of move away from that definition of white people.
So you think there's a whole group of, so-called white people who would think that this is nothing at all like me? You're talking, don't call it white people.
Oh, I call them the wrong kind of white people.
Not the people from your book. All right, let's go to Calvin in Platteville. Hi, Calvin.
Hello, ma'am.
Hey, go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to say I appreciate what you put in about Barack Obama.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of like I like the dichotomy of it. It's kind of like this about Hillary Clinton, but my sister-in-law is 19, and back in the primary, she couldn't figure out, didn't know yet who she was going to vote for. And I kind of tongue-in-cheek told her, I said, well, you have to vote for Hillary Clinton. You're a woman. You have to vote for your own because that's what's on the news. And then she asked me who I was going to vote for, and I said, well, I got to vote for Hillary Clinton because if I don't, I'm sexist. And it kind of... The way you said about Barack Obama, it kind of shows that there is a little bit of that kind of a feeling in there, unfortunately.
All right, thanks a lot for that call, Calvin. And Christian Lander, do you want to respond to that one?
Yeah, I mean, it was, this was from a post that was written when the site was expected to be read by six people, but it came from a significant percentage or portion of the people who I'm going after were viciously anti-Hillary Clinton without actually listening to anything that Barack Obama had said.
And to Kathy in Wapaka. Hey, Kathy, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to prove you wrong on a couple of points here. I consider myself a liberal person, but I hate shorts. I detest shorts. I'm an adult. I have a pair of capri pants. Shorts are for kids, or at least they used to be for kids. And now you see the abomination of something called dress shorts. It's like, you know, who the hell came up with that? And the other thing, I wonder if it's on your list, self-tanners. I refuse to wear shorts because I don't want to buy a self-tanner so I can be the proper shade of tan. Is that on your list by any chance?
No, tanning is generally seen as an activity preferred by the wrong kind of white people. Because the white people I'm going after generally don't like cancer.
Although self-tanners sort of figure large in fashion magazines.
Yes, but the white people that I'm going after have vigilant hatred towards fashion magazines.
Yeah, dress shorts. I have to agree with Kathy there. That is a bit of an oxymoron. I've never understood the dress shorts thing.
No, that one's shorts. Shorts is complicated. I'm not going to lie. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to really understand here, but they're essential to some outdoor activities.
All right. Thanks for your take there, Kathy. And on to Casey calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Casey.
Hey, hey. I just wanted to say I think this is a great idea. Like, everything that you say is, like, so true. I'm the wrong kind of white person because, like, I hang out with minorities a lot and I don't do the normal white activities or whatever. But I think this book is this page, website, everything that you're doing, I think it should be done for every race. And then it'll open up people's eyes and people can see, you know, to think outside the box.
Well, you can become the right kind of white person if you tell people that you're hanging out with minorities, because you can use that. One of the entries in the book is number 14, having black friends.
You want to read a little bit from that?
From that post?
Yeah.
Sure, hang on, let me find it. Because the important thing is you're looking for friends in terms of, there's also having gay friends in there, and the important thing is really to put together a friendship roster, sort of like a fantasy baseball team. So, post number 14, having black friends. Much has been made about the way that white people adore all aspects of black culture and history. These days, the majority of hip-hop, jazz, blues, and African-American history fans are actually white people. Ask white people about Cornel West, and they might be moved to tears of respect. Very rare. So it comes as no surprise that white people love having black friends. They serve many valuable functions. The most important role that black friends can play in white culture is that they can use as physical evidence that white people are not racist. Did you know that if you are able to acquire a friend of every race, then you are officially designated as the least racist person on Earth? Though this is impossible, white people treat it the same way that Buddhists view enlightenment, unattainable, but with great virtue in the attempt. Black friends can also be used to confirm that a white person is knowledgeable about African-American culture. Many white people are constantly striving to be recognized as experts, and many consider it a life achievement to be befriended and acknowledged by a black person. But note, do not dole out your praise like pinata candy. Once white people have achieved this goal, they'll be more difficult to manipulate. So it's best to tease them with little bits of praise, balanced with a few barbs. For example, I have to hand it to you for putting KRS-One on that party mix. I mean, you went with a pretty well-known song, but still, good job. Also note that all white people fantasize about being brought to an authentic African-American experience, such as a Baptist church or a barbecue restaurant in a neighborhood that they are afraid of. Finally, an abundance of black friends, defined in white culture as two, also enables a white person to be a resident expert on African-American issues when there are no black people around. Moving beyond friendship, some white people actively seek out opportunities to begin romantic relationships with black people. Dating, marrying, and subsequently having a child with a black person is considered one of the greatest things a white person can do. It delivers a lifetime of opportunities to get offended and feel superior to friends with white children, but still ranks slightly behind adopting foreign children, post-133.
And one of the interesting things about that post to me is, what is the point of view there? Who's talking? Did you have that in mind when you wrote that?
The point of view is it's the guide, right? I mean, it's a guide to the unique taste of millions.
But it doesn't sound like a white person writing it.
No, but it's meant to be written. I mean, but it is a white person, right?
Right. Well, it is, but
it's meant to have this guidebook mentality to it, and sort of, you know, tap into some of the travel guide aspects of it.
Okay, let's take another phone call. Matt on the line from De Pere. Hi, Matt. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How you doing? I have a book that's really funny that I recommend to your guest. It's called The Anthropology of the Caucasian Americans. Mm-hmm. And it's an underground book, but it's a Native American press book, and it's all written as if white people are all dead and we've just discovered their remains and everything. And it's written, it's just really fun to read, simply because they'll point out things like that, like lawn mowing is this ritual that these people had every week, and they had to perform this ritual every single week, and that every time they mentioned something about Caucasian Americans, just like some people have written Native American books, they will do things like put pronunciations in parentheses and stuff. And one of the funniest things is even the index in the book, the credits of thanking people, it says things like, it mentions all of these Native American people who have done the research, and at the very end, they thank this one white person that they talked to for, you know, making sure that all this information is correct.
What is the book called?
The Anthropology of White Caucasian Americans.
You ever heard of that one, Christian Lander?
No, it sounds funny, though.
It's interesting about the spinoff sites that you mentioned. Are they as popular as your site?
No.
And what are they again?
So there's many of them. So there's stuff educated black people like, stuff Asians like, stuff brown people like, stuff Latinos like, stuff Indians like, stuff gay people like, and it goes on and on and on. There's a lot.
So why do you think they're not as popular as your site?
Well, not to sound like a jerk here, but a lot of them aren't really that funny. They're just, and it's not about the subject matter, it's more about the writers. And the other one is, I mean, you know, mine was the first one.
Mm-hmm. So you're spawned the rest of them.
Yeah.
What about the branding, though? I mean, there's so much branding with your book, it seems like that sort of corners the market.
Yeah, I think that might be the case. But I don't really know what's going to come out of these. But I mean, I think the sites are great. I'm glad that people are doing them. I just wish they were a little funnier.
Okay, let's go and take a call from Robin in Stevens Point. Hi, Robin.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I was just wondering if anybody's ever made the point that, at least to me, this sounds like the yuppie version of Jeff Foxworthy's You Might Be a Redneck If.
Well, you see, the funny thing is people use the term yuppie a lot, and I want to see, one of the key parts of yuppie is the U in yuppie stands for urban. And these people that I'm talking about are everywhere. They're in urban environments, to be sure. But, I mean, they're also in college towns where they, you know, degrade everyone who lives around them, and they call them cultureless.
Christian, tell us a few of your favorites from this book. What's your favorite entry or two?
So one of my favorite entries is number 4 on assists, meaning passing in, like, basketball and hockey. I don't know why that one always stands out. It's really funny to me. Indie music, I think, really hit home, and one on Wes Anderson movies.
So these are all things, you know, I guess that's sort of what makes it funny, and to talk about it is sort of redundant, but is that it's the unique taste of millions. Often indie music, there, you're listening to music because you say you want to discover it, so you can say you were into this band before they were big.
Yes.
So, you know, you want to be a trendsetter, you want to be different, but everyone's doing exactly the same thing. That's what's kind of sad about the whole thing.
I mean, that's definitely the funny response I get. It's a lot of people are like, yep, you nailed me. And what's happened is that people were sort of used to the representation of you know, the term white people to apply only to, you know, sort of the stereotypical, you know, sort of nerdy country club, suburban, lawn mowing type people, instead of going after this urban and, you know, college town group who consider themselves to be completely unique. And sort of saying, no, actually, you know, you're a part of a giant society of people that are marketed to and can be as easily narrow-casted as the masses that you hate so much.
Take a call now from Gretchen, calling from Sun Prairie. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi, my name is Gretchen. I'm a Tibetan immigrant in 1992. among 1,000 Tibetans, if you have heard of us, about the white people participating or contributing more for PBR, right? NPR, or National Public Radio and TV station. I think it's largely because white people are much more open, willing to open themselves to other cultures, willing to learn about other people. I find the white majority much more educated. I think that's the reason why white majorities participate in NPR and NBS. I work with a great number of white and black people at my workplace, and I'm more easily adaptable with the white people, and I have to take it took me a while to get acquainted with the black people, even though they are such wonderful people. It took me a while because they were not as willing to open to us then, like the white people. And with the Tibetan situation, political situation, white people are willing to listen to what I have to say about my country and its political situation. And once they understood, they're more willing to come out and support us too. So I think it's about education. The white majority are much more educated than the black and other minorities, and that's my opinion.
Christian Lander, do you want to take that?
That wasn't quite where I was going with all this, but I mean, one of the things about white people and other cultures is that the book points out is there's also a striving to adopt or take on parts of other cultures. I mean, post number two is religions their parents don't belong to. And so white people are very, very eager to open themselves up to these other cultures because they feel as though they have none of their own that's worthwhile because their culture is a history of the Crusades and colonization and all this awful stuff. They're desperate to distance themselves from it. So they desperately cling to anything that they can try to claim as their own, you know, pick a culture that hasn't been obsessed over by white people yet.
And we've got an email here I just want to share before we go into our break. Matt asks, is your list on your list? From Matt in Madison, sent from his iPhone.
I get that one a lot. And I spent too much time in graduate school with people using the word meta for me to do that.
Okay, we're talking to Christian Lander, author of the book Stuff White People Like and creator of the website by the same name. Is there something you'd like to add to Christian Lander's list or something that bothers you about it? Anything you want to share, you can call us up this morning at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, the number, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Veronica Rickert with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11 o'clock, join us for Larry Mueller's program. After 11, the talk turns to national energy policy, including the proposed policies of presidential candidates McCain and Obama. Veronica Rickert with you today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk with Christian Lander, author of the book and website Stuff White People Like. And Christian Lander, I can't shake the feeling, I feel a little bit like William Shatner during this interview, a little bit like a caricature of myself because of the NPR thing. I'm curious, did you get picked up by sort of non-NPR stations? Where has this book been written about and interviewed?
Literally everywhere. It's amazed me how much it's been picked up. So I have done a number of interviews with conservative talk radio, which has been interesting. NPR, I was on Talk of the Nation with Neil Conan. That was the first NPR interview that I did. And then there were some other ones, Canadian public radio, the CBC. I've been on a few of those. And then just regular talk radio and a few XM stations.
What was the conservative talk show like for you?
It was sort of interesting because I'm very much going after myself and a lot of the contradictions that I see in sort of the liberal left. And it's been funny because the right has done a very, very bad job of making fun of the left. Like, they never seem to get it right. Whereas the left usually does a great job of making fun of the right. You know, the Daily Show, Colbert Report, they do a fantastic job. And granted, they do have more material to work with. And so when something comes along that sort of makes fun of this group in a way that's effective and actually funny, it resonated. And so they were really happy with it, and it led to a little more, a few more hateful callers than I was expecting. Not hateful towards me, but hateful towards liberals than I was expecting.
So did they thank you for helping them out?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people think that I'm a raging conservative. I think some publication called me Dick Cheney Jr.
And what do you think about that?
Oh, I think that's fantastic. I'm glad. I don't really find. I mean, again, when I was in graduate school, I found that a lot of the people I went to school with were absolutely intolerant left wing liberals who refused to listen to anybody else who didn't share their point of view, and yet still called themselves open minded. So, I mean, I'm very happy that people will assume that I'm on either side, which is great. I mean, I don't really want to be a part of the culture wars, which I think they're not effective for anybody.
Well, do you think you're going to see some of this stuff picked up in the election?
Which stuff?
Well, you know, your critique of liberals in this book, you know, it could be fodder for McCain's campaign.
No, I don't think he has the internet yet. But I am hoping that, like, white people become the new soccer moms for the upcoming election, like, as far as the term goes.
Let's take another phone call. We've got Peter on the line from Stoughton.
Good morning. As a semi-white person, I smoke non-filtered cigarettes, but I do claim a monopoly on irony. I believe that me and white people of my ilk, we're the only people who understand it, and the rest of the world, you know, forget it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is why irony is number 50 in the book. I mean, it's essential to understanding white people to really understand irony.
That's a good entry. Do you want to read a little of that?
Sure. Let me just flip to it. This one is pretty essential if you're just getting to know white people, that you should really know this one. So, irony. White people hate a lot of stuff. Republicans, TV, Vin Diesel movies, SUVs, fast food. But every once in a while, they turn that hate into sweet irony. White people will often make a joke about how hard it is to define irony. It's not that funny. And back in the 90s, people got all upset at Alanis Morissette for using the term improperly in her hit. Isn't it ironic? But the reason that white people love irony is that it lets them have some fun and feel better about themselves. The most horrific recent example is trucker hats, which shockingly went from mainstream in the 80s to ironic in the early 2000s, and then almost immediately back to mainstream. Santa hats are not rare or unique in any way. Once something reaches this stage, irony cannot be restored for at least a decade. Other examples would include white people getting together to have a white trash night, where they'll eat Kentucky Fried Chicken, drink Bud Light, watch Larry the Cable Guy, or The Marine, or maybe listen to Kid Rock or P.O.D. These events allow white people to experience things they're supposed to hate, all while feeling better about their own lives, decisions, and cultured tastes. Occasionally, white people will put an ironic knick-knack in their home or apartment, such as a Support Our Troops magnet or a bottle of Mickey's. This can be used to your advantage. If you need to appear cool to white people, you just need to pick something that was popular 10-plus years ago and put it in a prominent place on your desk or in your home. A CNC Music Factory cassette and a Too Legit to Quit t-shirt would be good examples. Also, you might find yourself in a conversation where you mention that you like something, and there's an awkward silence indicating that it is not cool. In this situation, you must say, "Oh yeah, I also like insert similar things in such a way to show that you were kidding about this first thing," and smile. The white people will laugh, and all will be well.
I don't know why I really like that entry. Okay, let's go to Steve, Fort McCoy. Hi, Steve.
Hey, I just finished that book. It is awesome. I loved it. But I want to know what happened to Harley Davidson. White people love Harley Davidson.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for the kind words. Harley Davidson have been pretty popular with... it's tough because the love of Harleys is spread between these kind of white people and the wrong kind of white people. I mean, Harley sort of made that push into making, licensing their logo to everything. Bandanas, T-shirts. They sell their clothing at in beach towns, which is not usually a good sign. East Coast beach towns.
Well, thanks for the suggestion, Steve. And have you gotten any other suggestions that you think are going to make it onto the list?
I got a suggestion recently in Chicago. Someone said I should put Africa on the list, and that one's definitely coming.
Do you have an idea what the entry's going to say?
Well, it's basically going to say that white people love everything about Africa except actually going there.
You've got a funny, that reminded me of Angelina Jolie, which in turn reminds me of your chart for how to pick a baby name.
Yes, the taxonomy of white children.
Yeah, can you explain that one?
So it's a flow chart that I put in the book that helps people determine how to name a white child. And you sort of follow these series of questions about, do you consider gender a social construct? And it sort of guides you through this whole process until you find a name for the child.
Give us an example. Can you follow one along?
Sure. This is actually one of the flowcharts that people have responded to most favorably. So the first question is, do you consider gender to be a social construct? And if the answer is no, the next question is your child an international adoption? If the answer is yes, it'll move on. Does the child already have a name? If the answer is yes, you're supposed to use the given name, be offended when people pronounce it incorrectly. If the answer is no, then you have a decision, are you adopting a boy or a girl? And then if you have a boy, ask the question, do you know the native language's word for peace? If the answer is yes, use that. If the answer is no, purchase a dictionary to look it up.
And some of the names on there, read us just some of the names that you can wind up with.
Sebastian, Caleb, Reed, Emily, Cristiano, Aaron, George, Willow, River.
Well, I have to admit, Reed and Sebastian were two names that we considered when we named our son. So,
did you want them to play rugby or lacrosse? Because those are the implications.
I think we'd have to go for rugby. Yeah, interesting.
And Sebastian was the name you were looking for.
It's a little uncomfortable, isn't it? To see yourself that clearly, it's a little bit like you kind of do have to laugh till it hurts.
Yep.
Okay, Maggie in Iola. Hi, Maggie, you're on the air.
Well, hi there. I wonder whether he felt that the attendees at the Comic-Con in San Diego especially needed his message, because he was there.
Yep, I was there. I love Comic-Con, first of all. I've been the last 3 years, and I was there for Sunday of this year signing books. And what was amazing was, so I've been to a few book signings. I've only done four of them so far. And at the book signings, everybody there was coming to see me, so they knew who I was. At Comic-Con, nobody had any clue who I was, because there were so many more famous people there, you know, or people with higher stature. And it was pretty incredible. I always love being there, because I mean, I'm a nerd myself, and you go to Comic-Con, it's amazing persecution-free zone for being a nerd for 3 days, where you just go as far as you want and never worry about anyone, you know, going after you.
And Comic-Con is a comic convention, right?
Yes, in San Diego.
I want to mention we've got an open line right now, open line or two actually, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And we've got a couple emails here I want to read. This one comes from Joseph, who says, I'm surprised with all this talk of things white people love, PBR, Pabst Blue Ribbon, hasn't been mentioned.
PBR does get an informal shout out in the book, but he's very right. It does deserve its own entry.
And then here's another one from Ginny, who says, your discussion made me very aware of generational differences. By the ideals mentioned, I can see that this represents an age group much younger than mine. My own generation, born during World War II, doesn't seem to identify with so much with consumerism. That's from Ginny in Washington. And that's a question I had, too, is it seems to me like this book couldn't have been 10 years ago in any way. Do you think that this is just a moment of our time? Do you think this book will be true in even 5 years?
Well, my first thing is I'm actually a little upset at that email, because I believe that the baby boomers were more driven by consumerism than anybody. And, you know, I get very frustrated being of this generation and having to put up with the sort of mass media belief that the boomers were this fantastic generation that solved everything, when they were the generation that gave us gated communities and allowed the environment to be destroyed and, you know, really were unbelievably selfish. And so I have some rage towards the baby boomers, who sort of want to believe that their generation was so much better than ours. And that comes through a little in the book. But it is, I think it's less generational than you would expect. Some of the readings, a lot of the people are a lot older than I would expect, who really identify with a lot of stuff in the book.
You know, there are a lot of people who say that part of the reason Barack Obama has a good shot at winning is because of the rage that you're talking about against boomers, and you're not alone in that. A lot of people are saying, let's move on already, enough about the boomers.
Yeah, I mean, it's frustrating. I mean, it's very frustrating to just hear over and over again about how fantastic the 60s were and how everything changed and how everything that the boomers did was perfect and fantastic and everything that we do is terrible and consumerist is frustrating and terrible.
Take another call from Chris in Glendale. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
I just wanted to mention three printed resources. One of them is a book by McFadden. The first name, I think, is Cyra, C-Y-R-A. And this book from 1976 was called The Serial. And it looked at life in Marin County and was a parody of educated left-wing Caucasian culture. It was made into a major motion picture around 1980 with Martin Mull and other stars. Then a conservative named David Brooks wrote a book called Bobos in Paradise. And I'm sure you're familiar with that. Third item, going back to the early 70s, I distinctly remember an issue of the National Lampoon, which back then was written by quite well-educated people who were politically diverse. They had an article on great moments in white culture, and one of the artifacts mentioned was Rice Krispies marshmallow treats. And I thought this was brilliant. What was being held up for inspection were great achievements by white people, yet they weren't. They were sort of boring, suburban, middle-class artifacts, and I thought that was quite witty in a way that's very difficult to put into words.
The other one to add to the bibliography, or the annotated bibliography that we're putting together here, and yes, there's a graduate school reference in there, is Spy Magazine. If you ever see one of their anthologies, do a fantastic job of skewering these people in just the same way.
And speaking of graduate school, that one's in there, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As a dropout of Indiana University, a PhD dropout, I can certainly relate to that post.
Why do white people love graduate school?
Well, there's a number of reasons. One is that the book really talks about this competitiveness within white people to be better than your neighbor. And, you know, having a master's degree in English is one way to differentiate yourself and have physical proof that you're smarter than somebody. Even though, of course, graduate school is no real indication of actual intelligence.
And what I like about that entry is at the end of it, you say graduate school has one of two outcomes. One is that people drop out and they realize that there's no point to it and they go back to a city and do something else, or they wind up in a small town and tell people that they're smarter or talk about how cultured they are.
Yep, exactly. Those are the only two outcomes. And then, of course, there's options of graduate school for like medicine and law, but those are a little too useful for the people I'm going after.
Okay, an email here from Ryan who says stuff that white people like. He says, young white people, in quotes, living in urban neighborhoods that are in transition, gentrification, that brings a level of authentication and edginess that legitimizes their existence.
Yep, number 73, gentrification. And I also include a gentrification timeline in the book to let you know what stage your neighborhood is in. And for people who are curious, the cycle is complete when the Whole Foods opens.
Can you read the cycle?
Okay, hang on. I have to find where that one is. It should be near the 70s here. All right. So the cycle begins in a gentrification timeline. The first stage is an independent coffee shop opens. And then a little further along, there's an announcement of a planned Starbucks. And then immediately following that, there's a protest of that Starbucks opening. Then the Starbucks opens. Then there's a creation of live-works lofts. Then the ungentrified areas nearby are now called east/west gentrified area. Then a candle or a stationery store opens. Then an organic bakery, then a transient hotel is renovated, then Trader Joe's opens, a celebrity chef will open a restaurant, there will then be a dinner party to celebrate the opening of the Trader Joe's, the final original resident of the neighborhood moves out, then young parents move in, this is very, very deep on the gentrification line, then the first wave of gentrification people declare the area is played and begin the process again in east-west gentrified area. And then the Whole Foods opens, signifying the end of the process.
I like that one, too. Okay, let's see. I think we have time for one more call. Let's take Megan in Madison. Hi, Megan.
Hi. I just kind of had a comment that comes to the whole theme about, you know, making fun of my people, and I can use it as a tool to break down race and have interesting conversations. Well, I live in Uganda, and I'm actually dating a Ugandan man, and I used this website as a way to explain myself. When a lot of times we have cultural nuances come up, we talk about sushi, I'd put them to the entry, and we were able to break down a lot of cultural barriers with your blog.
That's fantastic. I'm very happy to help.
All right, thanks a lot for that call, Megan. And Bruce, one more in Madison. Hi, Bruce, you're on the air.
Hey, I got something white folks don't like. Long story short, I grew up in Low Country, South Carolina, which is heavily influenced by West African culture. And I know in other places, Latin America, Philippines, they do the same thing. Boiled peanuts.
Yeah.
Every time I go home, I buy 5 pounds of boiled peanuts, and I guarantee you none of them make it north of the Ohio River because I eat every one of them, okay?
Yeah.
But you take them up here. And these people up here go, what? So it's a culture thing and all kind of stuff like that. But I tell you what, y'all don't know what you're missing.
I'll tell you, you know what? I can actually relate. In Los Angeles, in Santa Monica, there's a restaurant called Nook, and it's opened by a white guy from Georgia, and he serves. He gives boiled peanuts as sort of a free appetizer to everyone there. And at almost every table in the restaurant, they're never touched.
I've had boiled peanuts. I kind of like them.
They're all right. My wife went to the University of Georgia, and so I tried them. I'm a little so-so.
Christian Lander, thanks so much for being with us today. It was fun.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. Christian Lander is the author of the book Stuff White People Like and the website by the same name. You can order a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444. And ask for program 730E. Thank you to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and Carmen Jackson for her on-air production today. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.